Welcome to NFP, the Non-Fungible Podcast, with your host, Dee Klein. Today on NFP, Hi-Fi Finance CEO Doug Leonard joins me for a discussion that begins with a focus on the collapse of the Silicon Valley Bank and future implications of the meltdown. Then we talk about Hi-Fi Finance and the introduction of pooled NFTs, whereby NFT holders can earn revenues by providing trading liquidity with their collected tokens. Hey, this is NFP, the Non-Fungible Podcast, with me, Dee Klein. Today's episode is brought to you by the Koi Network. Koi makes minting NFTs super easy and inexpensive. Just drag and drop your file using their NFT wallet, Finny, and Koi takes care of the rest. Minting costs as little as 1 cent, so you can create as many NFTs as you want. And when they're viewed by other people, you even earn Koi tokens that you can use to fund your next series. Check it out at koii.network. All right. Hey, welcome to NFP. Doug Leonard, CEO of Hi-Fi Finance. I'm so glad you could join me today.
Thanks for having me, Darren. Really excited to be here.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, I have to start off with something that I was reading up about you, and I don't know if it's true. Is it true you have a giant Bitcoin tattoo on your butt?
It's true. It's true if you use LinkedIn as your single source of information.
It wasn't the only source, I swear.
Oh, there you go. Well, I put that on LinkedIn a while back, but I think it introduces you to my sense of humor. I have no tattoos, so. But
oh, really? That's a little disappointing, Doug. I was kind of hoping it was true.
Yeah, maybe we could get some temporary tattoos. So
okay. Okay. And Bitcoin Cash on the other cheek, maybe something like that.
Yeah. I mean, every fork, right? We need to get every single, you know, we should get some BSV in there. I mean, really,
BSV.
We should just limit ourselves.
Oh, man. So, I mean, you've been around since 2012 in blockchain, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's when I got my start.
You've seen all the upheaval that happened over the years and the upheaval right now. I don't know. Does it feel different to you? Same? Is this just more of the same? Or like, are we okay? Okay, just for the listeners listening, okay, this show is not financial advice. So just be clear here. We're just talking about our opinions here. Do not base any of your financial decisions on this conversation. But Doug, is this just yet another, you know, undulation in what happens in the crypto world? Or is this something different? What do you think?
Well, I think at this point, millennials in general are getting kind of tired of the 100-year black swan events that we've had like throughout our lives.
Every and so a few months.
but we're becoming numb to it. And so I think either we are like preparing like the greatest generation of people who are going to be very well hedged and stable, or we're going to go the other route and we're just going to not trust anything. And maybe that will be the foundation for kind of this transition to more transparent tools that will have a different set of problems. They're not going to be perfect, but they'll at least try to address the issues that we've seen in our lifetime. So, you know, this is my third cycle. Each cycle is kind of triggered by something different. I remember signing up for my Mt. Gox account, and then right as KYC passed, it just imploded. And so like, yep. I dodged a bullet there.
Up in Canada, you know, here, I had, when I was first getting into crypto, I was choosing between a couple of different exchanges at the time. And one of them was Quadriga.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. Fortunately, I never used them. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, you're totally fine. So this is my third cycle. And so each cycle, you know, I position myself better, try and take lessons learned, you know, and it's getting a little easier to kind of tell when things are frothy. But what was most concerning from this last cycle is just seeing how leveraged the larger players were and who got caught with their pants down. And it just seemed like everyone was just, you know, uber long and didn't have any sort of hedged position. Whereas, you know, at Hi-Fi, you know, we've, you know, formerly were called Mainframe. We launched our ICO in 2017. And I was an early employee at Mainframe. and watch that whole organization just boom and then go bust. But it had not a lot to do with like internal decision making. It was just like we had such high conviction in the crypto market, and then all those assets just had the bottom fall out on them. And we're like, oh, we believe in this, but we've got to run payroll. And so that has informed, you know, how I run the business today. And, you know, we transit on a nice buffer of cash so we can run payroll. We can, you know, last through, you know, these downturns. And so it, these types of things educate. It's the school of hard knocks for everybody. Yeah. But man, what a wild ride it's been.
Well, I mean, if we look at the Silicon Valley Bank situation, you know, I was talking with someone about this the other day, and they're like, well, what happened there? And I'm like, well, essentially, you know, when you look at that financial system, it all depends on trust. It all depends on trust. And if for whatever reason you lose trust, maybe it's Elizabeth Warren saying, oh, this, you know, this bank looks bad, or it's someone else that you follow on Twitter or whatever saying, hey, get your funds out, it falls apart. It falls apart because it's based on trust.
Yeah, I think, you know, so I have some different opinions kind of about like, you know, Bitcoin was kind of born out of this financial crisis where things were mismanaged. And when I kind of look back at the, you know, the financial history and the mistakes that were made in centralized finance, you know, DeFi and crypto generally just feels like we're speed walking the last 100 years of financial education. You think, you know, seeing things like Luna, Terra, you know, UST, that collapse, you know, very different than USDC depegging today. But it really does feel like, yeah, we can't go a month without something, you know, really being stress tested to the point of a little bit of a cracking. But looking into kind of, you know, what went on with Silicon Valley Bank, it's rather interesting, because when you peel back the curtain, you know, banks are highly regulated, especially since the 2008 financial crisis. When you go back in your history, you see like mortgage-backed securities were this new thing. You know, they'd really only been introduced for, I think it was like 4 years when the 2008 crisis. So it took like 4 years before like we just really like muck things up, because in a large system, you know, especially a capitalistic system, the only guardrails are, you know, to greed are the laws and the regulations. And so 2008 happens and we just say, look, banks, you know, our entire nation depends on this and we need people to have confidence. And so we are only going to let banks invest into, you know, these, you know, essentially government treasuries, you know, bonds. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredibly safe investment unless you need to come up with liquidity for, you know, a large number of your depositors. And so what happened? Very, very simply, you know, the, you know, SVB, from what I can see on the surface, like there's nothing crazy illegal, you know, that really is going on. Certainly it appears that any investors or equity holders are not going to be walking away with a penny, which is a relief for a lot of people. But depositors, from what I'm reading, are going to be just fine. They're going to be made whole or very close to whole. Okay. So certainly those with less than $250,000 in an account are going to get every dime. For those that have more than $250,000 that extend beyond the FDIC insurance limit, that is, you know, potentially it's going to take some time for the assets to be liquidated off. I understand that there is large swaths of those assets that have already been liquidated. And the FDIC is, you know, operating Silicon Valley Bank at this point, and they are in charge of the liquidation of those assets. So I think we'll have something either today or tomorrow, kind of as an official announcement. But, you know, so the wide sweeping impacts is like, there's nothing different about their bank and where they parked, you know, depositors' money and every other regional bank out there. And so the concern is, you know, everybody is kind of waking up to this fact that like, oh, having more than $250,000 in a bank account comes with significant trade-offs. And there are products out there which will, like, you know, it's called a sweep, where you end up, you know, working with one institution and they deposit 250K across five different, you know, institutions. And, you know, you kind of get one or $1.25 million of FDIC coverage. I mean, it would be worthwhile for us to take a look at this system as in terms of, like, is this what we really want? It, you know, do we like that people are forced to spread it out? But everything is going to be fine here. But if you need to run payroll on the 15th, you're probably not feeling like everything is going to be fine.
Right. From what I read, it was like something like 90% of their clients are holding more than 250K, because it's basically a venture capitalist bank. Like, it's not a bank that's widely used by, you know, casual clients with, you know, 10,000 bucks in their bank account.
Yeah. And so, like, but the real trigger here was the fact that we have Jerome Powell, who's out there trying to combat inflation at all costs. Yeah. And so when you have a institution who can only buy treasuries, and then we have a sudden shift in valuation on treasuries, which, like, you know, SVB is sitting on all these loans that are paying out 1%, you know, through maturity. And then today you can go and park your money with the Fed and earn a risk-free 5% return.
Right.
And so everyone is looking at, like, oh, you know, I get 0.01% return in my savings account. Why don't I just go and park money with the Fed and pull out 5%? So that is that, like, economic pressure to pull your money out of the bank and go park it with the Fed is what is causing, which is basically just a liquidity shortage. Like, there's the money is still there, and the United States government is as good as it has ever been at printing money and paying off its debt. and so, like, you know, this is like one thing we've gotten down. Like, we know how to print money. Like, you might think
the U.S. is very good at that,
right? And there's a purpose behind it. The whole purpose behind a centralized currency is to serve a certain population of people and offer them stability. And so we at the United States try to, like, you know, shrink and expand the money supply to, you know, do either different things politically with monetary, you know, our monetary supply, or just try to, like, balance out, like, times right now, we want to get inflation under control because it will do much more harm if we let it run rampant. Now, the real interesting question is Jerome, you know, has Jerome actually reached his limit on what he is willing to do to continue to stress test the market? Because what this would mean, you know, in terms of what you might rationally expect as the outcome, if they have to either pause or cut rates, the markets are just going to rally because they see an end to it, and which is not necessarily good for inflation, but is, you know, everybody is trying to time the bottom of this, you know, especially with the risk on assets that need to borrow money. And we may have reached that limit. Time will tell. But it's not going to come without its trade-offs in terms of what you're paying at the grocery for your, you know, basic necessities of life, housing costs, you know, just inflation in general, what employees cost in terms of, you know, the wage price,
wage growth,
you know, kind of spiral. Yeah. So a lot to kind of take in there, but nothing criminal. I mean, there might be something criminal, but, like, nothing on the surface that is very criminal. Every bank is like this. And so, you know, we basically have 48 hours in order for, you know, the FDIC, Janet Yellen, and everyone to restore confidence in the banks. But I bet you Monday is going to be a very busy day, you know, for everybody. You know, and even internally at Mainframe, we're just, you know, looking at, okay, what are we doing, and how should we change, you know, how we manage our treasury going forward? And one thing that's on the table is opening up an account directly with the Fed itself, to just purchase, you know, treasuries directly from the Fed, and then you don't have to trust some other institution to, you know, custody those for you at all. So
interesting.
But a domino effect, contagious, you know, this is, you know, contagion is very, you know, very much on the table. And if we saw that, it's probably going to have to get, everybody involved. You know, we'll probably see something from Biden. We'll see something from, you know, Jerome. We'll see something from Janet. So it's like all these, you know, names and leaders of the U.S. economy will have to show up and have to basically say, like, look, we will backstop this with everything we have. Nobody mm-hmm. who is a depositor will be walking away, you know, without, you know, either a tiny haircut or no haircut at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, just in terms of context for listeners, you know, maybe not realizing the scale of this. I mean, this is the, I think, 16th largest bank in America. And yeah. I think it's the second largest collapse of a bank in recent history. Like,
yes,
at least since the 80s. I think it's 84 was the last big one. Washington, I think, Mutual, I think, if I'm right.
That's correct.
So, I mean, it's a big deal.
Yeah, very, very big deal. So let's see how that, you know, how did this like impact us in crypto this weekend? So within DeFi, and we're one of these protocols that took this risk, we sort of sat down and we said to ourselves, if USDC ever lost its peg, something bigger is going on, and this is kind of an acceptable risk because, you know, we, along with many other DeFi protocols, trusted kind of the system that had been built. It's not so much trust in like the, you know, the people at Circle or Coinbase. You know, of course those people are trustworthy, but it was more just like we can't imagine a better system than what Circle has been building. And so we have hard-coded the price of USDC into our protocols at exactly one, so that no matter what, it's always worth $1 in our protocols. Coinbase does this inside of their exchange. Some interesting charts where Coinbase shows the price of USDC as a dollar, but the chart behind it is just going crazy. And when usually it's a flat line. DYDX, you know, they hard coded USDC as you know, a dollar. Compound in V2 did it. And then, you know, you look at Aave and they, you know, paused all stablecoin deposits. So what ended up happening is Circle publicly announced, you know, transparently, as soon as they had, you know, information to understand how they were impacted, they basically keep all of their money in one of two places. The first category is short-dated 3-month treasuries, which is a great place to keep money. And then the second place is they have bank accounts across, you know, I don't know, maybe like 5 institutions.
Yeah, I think one it was
of those
five
institutions.
Six,
yeah. Yeah, so one of them is, you know, SVB. And so they tried to get their money out. They weren't able to at the time. And so people started pricing, you know, USDC at 92 cents or below. I think it hit 88 cents at one, you know, one screenshot
like
I saw.
That, yeah.
But the 92 cents basically assumed that like the, you know, $2 or $2.8 billion they had in SVB would never be recovered. And so but it's really interesting because USDC, unlike, you know, UST, you know, you know, Terra Luna, these algo stable coins will go to zero, whereas USDC should never rationally go to zero. But in terms of like a study of psychology, this was a very interesting data point for, like, you know, people's behavior kind of spooking themselves out of this. You know, I personally just dumped all my Ethereum into USDC when it was trading at such a discount because it's an easy, you know, what, 8% on a weekend? Like, that's a great weekend.
It's an act of faith, though. I mean, there, you know, you are
absolutely
trusting based on what you, I mean, you're knowledgeable about it. You know, from what you've seen, it should come back. It should reestablish its peg.
And honestly, I think that, well, theoretically, and with the way the system is designed, like,
right,
there certainly was a certain amount.
Yeah, it's
of,
not like Luna, you know, or Terra USD. Right. It's not like, doesn't work the same way.
So, and I think this is what crypto and DeFi is going to start looking more and more like over the next 5 years, with, you know, everything kind of being classified as a security, or, you know, some things being security, some things not. The lack of clarity yet. You know, Gary Gensler saying that there is clarity, and yet there's, you know, clearly not. Like, if people in your classroom all score, you know, if they all fail the standardized test, there might be something wrong with the teacher. It might not be the student's yeah. fault, right? So, like,
right.
And maybe it's not even the teacher. It could be the broader school system or the approach to learning. But, like, certainly there's a disconnect. And given that the
or SEC, the way you're measuring it,
absolutely, absolutely. So, I mean, it's going to be hard to argue with the Howey test, but certainly, like, we saw this whenever mortgage-backed securities were a brand new security. That, you know, we recognized that there wasn't like a company operating this that was going to materially impact how mortgage-backed securities behaved. It was just, you know, it was materially different than like a corporate structure. And so the SEC was granted, you know, by Congress, special permissions to go and like figure out what are the right rules for mortgage-backed securities. I anticipate that is the task that Gary and the SEC has to do. And what makes their job difficult is that calling all of crypto and being too general is totally a misnomer. It's just like it's a false, kind of accusation that you can make, because take example, UST and USDC, they're completely different. Fundamentally, mm-hmm. One has a corporate structure. Another is like a game theory type backed stable coin that failed. And, you know, I won't take opinions on, you know, kind of like, I it was a very interesting experiment. If Do Kwon didn't do it, somebody else was going to do it. I didn't participate. I can see the writing on the wall with those things. But like stable coins need to be grouped into a single, you know, that's like mortgage-backed securities. It's a certain type of crypto, and which is very different than like DAO governance or something like a MakerDAO, which is different from something like an Aave and a Compound. So like there are these categories that I think is an overwhelming job, because we've had this explosion of innovation where we're all going to be operating in a gray area until Gary Gensler puts out, you know, here's the stable coin like legislation or regulations. Here are the guidelines. Here is how to, you know, actually run it down. And a lot of times the way this stuff is actually figured out is through court cases and setting precedents right. In the law.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. So my hope is that we will get the same type of consideration that mortgage-backed securities did within crypto, and that we will classify each type of token offering differently. You know, real-world assets represent the largest opportunity for onboarding of value onto blockchain. Jamie Dimon, CEO of JP Morgan, he says that, you know, the future of stocks is tokenization. Like, he already sees it. Now, Now whether that means it's tokenization on a blockchain that's controlled by, right. You know, just a handful of US companies in the, you know, like the NYSE, and I don't know, but even if it's a centralized blockchain, we get a more transparent financial system, yep. A more open mm-hmm. financial system, and we have new financial primitives like the Uniswap liquidity position that doesn't exist inside our traditional financial system. You can kind of recreate them, but like to be able to just like hold a token that is, you know, adding liquidity to a certain market on each side and trading it along a curve, it's a really powerful financial primitive. So anyways, that's what I hope. And given that the SEC is there to serve, you know, people of the United States, I choose to believe that regardless if Gary has a chip on his shoulder or something, over time, I do believe that we will get the proper, the proper regulation in place. We might be behind for a bit, but then we'll, you know, come back, because if there's one thing that the United States has shown is that we will not let the dollar lose its dominance. And that's right. What's at stake here. So it's a big enough deal that, you know, we're going to show up, if not late, we'll dominate this space eventually.
Right. What do you think, a little bit related, of the recent news about, I think it was New York District Attorney saying Ethereum's a security, and what do you think of all the implications of that?
Well, the nice thing is district attorneys don't decide, you know, what is and isn't a security.
Right.
And let's just play it through. Let's just say it is a security, right? Mm-hmm. You know what's going to happen is we will invent a dumber form of, a token that doesn't meet your like definition of a security. Like all this, maybe we'll bring proof of work back. Like it's just like whatever we have to do to exist outside of those rules likely is going to emerge out of that type of game. If you want to play whack-a-mole, right. play whack-a-mole. But if you actually want to, you know, get yourself educated and show up and contribute to the future of finance, it's being built right under your nose. And so, and I know that's hard for an older generation to accept, but you know, we're moving to these open systems, and there's probably no turning back. Now, just like cash still has a place, and debit and credit cards didn't get rid of cash. I don't think that DeFi is going to get rid of, you know, title insurance companies or banks or anything like that. But I think that it's going to be an extension, and it's going to create a new set of trade-offs that will have its place in the broader financial system.
Yeah, now let's talk a little bit about DeFi. You've mentioned liquidity, but we haven't really talked NFTs yet. And of course, this is NFP. You know, one of the main focuses of the show is NFTs. And I know that you have a very interesting mechanism, pooled NFTs. Can you explain that? And I'll be honest, I don't know a lot about this. You know, I read up on it a little bit, but in terms of what's happening there, my impression is you're taking an NFT from a collection, you're putting it into a pool, similar to you would do if you added liquidity on Uniswap for any given pool. And with that, you are then able to swap it into an ERC-20, which of course then is much more portable or liquid, I guess. I guess where I'm a little unclear about it is, like, say for example, you've got this Bored Ape, I don't know, I'm just picking something popular, right? And it's worth, I don't know, 100K. All right, you put it into this pool. What's the motivation to do that? Are you not putting yourself in a position where you're going to potentially lose that NFT with someone else swapping that, and then you're going to have to swap it? And like, what's the motivation for doing that, I guess, is what I'm asking. Maybe you can explain it first and then get there.
Yeah, you bet. Okay, so this is a very, very simple primitive that it almost confuses people how simple it is. Okay. But the facts are, these pools are collection specific, okay? So, you know, Bored Ape and CryptoKitties will have two separate pools, and you can't deposit a CryptoKitty into a Bored Ape one or vice versa. And so every single token going into a specific pool all come from the same collection, and anybody can show up and trade any other NFT from the collection in or out of that pool and pool whatever they want in or out. And so the ERC-20 tokens are always backed one-to-one with an NFT from that collection inside of the pool. Okay. Mm-hmm. As we set out to financialize NFTs, we saw that this didn't exist. There were other tools that kind of like got it close, but then they would like add a fee inside of it, like to like prevent you from getting your NFT out, or they built it directly into like an AMM type of model. Like the pool was inside the AMM, but this didn't give like the pure permission to just go do anything in DeFi that you wanted. So you deposit an NFT, you get, you know, one single ERC-20. So, and you receive an equal amount. You know, if you deposit 10 NFTs, you'll get 10 ERC-20 tokens. Now, what's powerful about an ERC-20 is the fungibility of it. You can fractionalize it, and then one is always transferable. You know, they're all equal. And so what you might reason is that if you put a really, really desirable NFT from a particular collection, a gold Bored Ape, into that pool, somebody's going to snatch it up and you're going to make their day. And so this tool is not designed for that type of use case. It is more of a liquidity pool that exists at the bottom or the more common side of the collection. Okay. And it can act as an easy way to facilitate trading between people. You know, we don't take a fee, you just pay for gas. So this is like a total public good that we're trying to put out there. And our motivations are to drive, you know, then compatibility with our lending protocol at HiFi, but it doesn't, they're not mutually exclusive. You can go and do whatever you want with it. So which kind of gets us into the whole discussion about like new ways that you can earn with it, which is really timely with all the wars going on between OpenSea and Blur and the royalty debate on, you know, whether or not this should be a thing, or, you know, it's really disrupting the cash flows that were present. And so it's unlocked a lot of new potential earning possibilities for teams, collections, and their collectors. So let me talk about this from the perspective of the collection itself. So if you have an NFT collection, which we do at HiFi, and you want to grow your audience, this is a tool that can help you do that. And it has very interesting impacts on your collection itself. As your collection grows in price, you start to price people out along an exponential curve, because that's the way wealth is distributed. The number of people that can afford a $100 NFT purchase is an order of magnitude more than people who can afford a $1,000 NFT, right? And so sure. forth. So this type of distribution exists in our world. And if you would like to reach people who are, you know, on the lower end of what, you know, exposure they want to have or choosing to have or can afford, then a tool like this lets you fractionalize your collection, and you can buy $100 of Bored Ape Yacht Club. And if the community wants to, they can then token gate the, you know, certain channels for those people. And so you can grow your audience, and you don't have this like competition between, like, if you're too successful too fast, then like your ability to expand your reach and become a global brand is very limited because you've priced out most of the market. And so this has the impact of actually shifting the demand curve, because you're able to add a marginal purchaser at the fractional level, which puts it in more people's hands, which allows them to, you know, talk about their bags and, you know, have some sort of skin in the game associated with your brand. And what it does is it pulls off whole units of NFTs from marketplaces like OpenSea and Blur, which pushes up, you know, either reduces the liquidity there or pushes up the floor price, because you have these, you know, marginal, you know, audience members who are creating demand at these, you know, lower price points for the fractional pieces. So that's really cool for projects. And it becomes very important for a maturing economy to have the ability to exchange hands regularly. That's what like kind of drives the floor price of a collection, which is super important for the health of that, you know, mini micro economy. So that's from the perspective of a collection itself. But let's talk now for a moment about like a new revenue stream. So If you're a collection, you just had your revenue streams basically decimated overnight of nothing of your doing. And you may have gone into this with the assumption that that would be a part of your ecosystem forever. And it's just not. So what you
we're talking about the fact that royalties have pretty much been wiped out. Is that what you're referring to?
That's exactly right.
Right.
So with royalties, you know, because that was for the most part, you know, people are, you know, when I look at collections, they're either dropping a new collection, which kind of is dilutive to your brand or, you know, the existing right. collection. You're doing swag, which is asking for more money out of the pockets of your audience, which is limited based off the, you know, how expensive your collection is. Or you're doing like real world events, which have real costs. And so it's created this circumstance where the only real sustainable NFT projects are those who have some other ulterior motive. You know, look at Doodles, for example. Doodles exists just to get you off of Ethereum and onto Flow blockchain. That's the whole reason it exists. And they have a massive budget to, you know, go to South by Southwest and create these amazing experiences. Right. But don't make a mistake. It is a gateway to another, you know, ecosystem. Good for them. Like that's like cool. But it's hard to find an NFT collection that doesn't have some ulterior motive like that, right? You know, we've got Bored Ape and Yuga who promised this metaverse, which is like, who knows how that's going to turn out, but you know, good for them. Like they're sort of like a Veblen good at this point, where it's like, they're not behaving similarly as other projects in the space. Or you've got like tokens slapping on some, you know, ERC-20 that is just like, a, you know, I don't know what it is, but like some sort of dilutive token Ponzi system that is supposed to, you know, create muscle confusion with your finances so that like everyone thinks they're making money. I don't know how it really works, you know, but they've got staking, or you're like trying to do the VFriends, you know, where you're trying to create the next like Mickey Mouse or these characters and you're trying to build this brand, but you know, he's got, you know, Gary has funding from A16Z that is just, you know, he's got massive amounts of resources to just plug in energy into that ecosystem. So, you know, we can do that. So it's very hard for projects to be sustainable is my point. So what you can do as a project creator or community today is you can go to pooledNFT.com and you can go and take, if you have some reserves, or if you have even just from what you earned with royalties, you can purchase back, you know, dollar cost average back into your collection and keep half of your royalties. Because take the NFTs, deposit into pooledNFTs.com, and then take your, you know, ETH and your NFT ERC20 token that's collection specific and put it into a Uniswap pool. And what's interesting, if you create a pair against Ethereum and then a separate market with like USDC or DAI or whatever your favorite stablecoin is after this weekend, what you actually create is a system that is going to create value and drive value back to you as a community or project that is not dependent upon you putting more energy into promoting or, you know, there's a lot of burnout that happens in the NFT space because it requires so much attention. It's an economy of attention. And so because you essentially create this position that as a function of volatility of Ethereum versus a stablecoin, it will use your pool to arbitrage the value of Ethereum, which is constantly volatile. And so no matter what you do, if you're, you know, every person in your core team, you know, died on a horrific bus crash tomorrow, that liquidity will continue to be extractive from the supply because of the fees that are accruing to your Uniswap V3 LP position. So it's a little hard to follow, but as a function of volatility of Ethereum, your collection will actually pull from circulation your own collection. And so it adds liquidity there. You're earning fees as people go to Uniswap and trade, and it turns your collection into a payment token, right? Uniswap announced recently that any ERC20 token can be used to purchase an NFT. So, you know, we just went live with this in our community. Our collection is called PondBot, but you could use your PondBot ERC20, like the pool token, to go and purchase a Bored Ape or to go and purchase, you know, the Porsche NFT that they just launched. And so it adds this new layer of utility for projects to where NFTs are now payment tokens, you know, if you put them in the pool. So earning fees with Uniswap, plugging into all that DeFi has to offer, fractionalization and shifting the demand curve. There's a lot of benefits there for collections themselves. And then for collectors, they have now more options when it comes to their exposure and collections. So, you know, our hope is to build up the liquidity and allow you to borrow against your NFTs. And this is part of a broader plan where we see real world assets can only be, you know, represented on chain as one of two things, NFTs and ERC20s. And so This layer basically prepares us for a real world asset thesis where, you know, we've got this horse syndicate where horses are going to be represented as NFTs, and then we want to be able to borrow against them. And so you can go and buy your daughter a pony for her birthday, have it represented as NFT, and then tune in on Twitter and watch the actual race of your horse, and this thing can pay out a dividend to you. So the future of NFTs is really fascinating. We're trying to financialize it. And for collectors, now you can buy $100 worth of an NFT or dollar cost average into a collection. And rather than making a specific bet on a very specific NFT, you could just bet on teams, because that's what an NFT pool is. It's like you're betting on the Bored Ape brand, or you're betting on the Porsche NFT, because it's going to interchange what NFTs are actually backing it. But, you know, you have your 1/10 of a, you know, Bored Ape exposure, regardless of what happens in that pool.
Right. Now, you mentioned the pawn bots. Pawn bots are basically your way of demonstrating how this works. Am I correct?
That's right. We needed a safe way to test all this new technology out, right? Like it's high risk when you start getting money involved. And so we had to launch an NFT collection to basically say, hey, look, it's safe. you can see it, and this is what we're going to experiment with. And, you know, say something catastrophic went wrong. Well, we created it. We'll just reissue the token, you know, make it right to everybody. And so
you can fiddle with it until you know it's safe for other people to use it, right? And how what have you seen happen now with the Pawn Pods? Can you talk about that experience so far?
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing that happened is we have it's something like 20% of the entire collection actually in the pool. So it's probably one of the more liquid collections that even exists.
Just to reiterate, that would mostly be like floor price pieces in there, if I'm understanding correctly.
So if they are not floor pieces in there, then there is a incentive equal to whatever the least desirable or most common piece is, and the delta between whatever is in the pool. So people have been trading them out, and you know, we wanted to spice things up, so we threw some like fun ones in there so people would have a reason to go in and be incentivized to react. But yes, at this point, most of the community has had the time to look it over, and if they haven't, they're missing out on whatever is in there. But it is rational to think that these are all the floor ones. You should not expect there to be anything else in there. So we've seen, you know, so we've got 20% of our collection inside of this pooled NFT. And when you look at, you know, on the blockchain and on Uniswap, you can actually see that the PawnBots pool token is being used as a payment token to bridge into Tiny Dino's Porsche NFT, because right now we have almost $500,000 of liquidity paired with USDC, Ethereum, Tiny Dinos. Like it kind of became this thing where like people would just throw NFTs and create their own pools and then pair it against their PawnBots, because of course we launched it into our community of PawnBot holders. But it takes it, like you can, you know, take Tiny Dinos and PawnBots as they fluctuate differently. You know, I'm earning fees. And so it takes your idle NFT asset and it makes it productive. And so this is a passive income for NFT collectors. And so you know, take your bags you already have, pair them against each other and throw it into a 1% market on Uniswap, and you'll get some solid fees as a function of the volume of those collections. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Now I'm guessing the user experience at this point is relatively primitive. Like, is that something that's, you know, absolutely getting built out over time, or?
Yeah. So if you go to pulledNFT.com, you're going to see that like this thing was slapped together as fast as we could. And so in terms of the smart contracts were written, you know, almost 6 months ago, like we've been sitting on them and we have extensive tests on those. But in terms of the front end, I told the team, like, look, we want to shorten our feedback loop. We want to make sure that this is something people want to use, and then we'll come back and make it pretty. And so we ship this thing, and it's just got like an ETH scaffold front end, the stuff they use at hackathons to get this put together. We're actually just going to take it and throw it away, and then release a, you know, updated brand and a nicer front end. And so that's what, you know, you can look forward to in the coming months. But it is functional technically.
Okay, so it is something that, you know, probably not ready for like your casual user at this stage.
It technically is, it's just not an elegant experience.
Right.
So it just doesn't look pretty. We didn't put any effort into, you know, rounding our corners and, you know, putting any sort of color or splash on it. We just wanted to make it work. And so, if you're a, you know, somebody who really needs a polished interface, just purchase the pooled NFT on Uniswap, right? So you could get the address and you just go through Uniswap and buy it, and, you know, buy a fraction of, you know, Tiny Dino or a fraction of.
So where do people find this particular, where do people go to find this?
So if you need to find the actual address on our website, you just select the collection. And then it gives you a direct link to the Uniswap markets that exist for that specific collection. Shouldn't be too hard. It will only hurt your eyes for a second to look at our UX, and then you're on to Uniswap. So, it's a small price to pay.
Yeah, totally. Very interesting. Maybe we can't, you just talked about, you know, coming months, you know, maybe we can wrap up with what you see happening here for your work at HiFi Finance over the next few months.
Sure. So right now, we have a lot going on. And the high level of it is, we are taking a big bet on the future of NFTs and tokenization, basically being real world assets. You know, real world assets stands to be the largest onboarding of value that blockchain will ever see. Because once everything starts being tokenized, that's it. There's nothing else left to put, you know, onto the blockchain. And so we see this as a huge opportunity, and we want a front row seat. And we also believe so much in the thesis that blockchain can impact entire industries that we've gone out and we are working with partners. You know, so crownribbon.com is kind of our like breakout project where we've got horse syndicates that we're tokenizing, and we're going to bring those to the blockchain. And our work here with the pooled NFTs is to create this liquidity foundation so that we can shoehorn these types of assets into our lending protocol. So we want to borrow against real world assets. We want to borrow against NFTs. We want to borrow against, you know, ERC-20s. And our protocol now allows for that. We're fixed rate. And so, you know, even with like changing market dynamics, what you lock in as your rate is what you pay. And so it's all about creating predictability of outcomes for our users. And so, you know, we're really focused on driving TVL to HiFi. And so these are kind of the free tools that the community gets to have that plugs them into all of DeFi, let alone HiFi itself. So excited to make this contribution to the broader community, excited to help projects have new ways to earn revenue, and to hopefully help out with you know, the royalty conversation, and as they look for new ways to add revenue streams to support their staff. These are all things that are going to help our entire space mature.
Wow, fascinating. Well, thank you, Doug. I really appreciate you taking this time to chat with me. And yeah, we should catch up again in a few months, see how things are going.
Would love it. Thanks, Darren.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Hey, if you enjoyed this episode of NFP with Decline, please like and subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform.
Thanks again for listening to the Non-Fungible Podcast. See you again soon.